Thank you, and thank you for coming this afternoon. I love without further ado. Thanks, Eileen. I'm just going to say a few words. Thank you so much for coming, and then I'm going to introduce you to Andrew Reeves, who wrote this really, really interesting book that touches on. Well, it's like I'm describing your book to you. It touches on so many issues and things. It's just a fascinating, compulsively readable book. Anyway, Andrew Reeves is a widely published, award-winning environmental journalist and the editor-in-chief of Alternatives Journal, Canada's oldest environmental publication. He's been published in places like The Walrus, The Globe and Mail, and This Magazine, all sorts of places like that. And as I mentioned a couple of minutes ago, or a couple of seconds ago, he's the author of Overrun, Dispatches in the Asian Carp Crisis. That's really hard to say. Well done for managing that, because I can. Anyway, please welcome Andrew Reeves.
Okay, first things first. Is this good from like a sound level perspective? Can everyone hear me? Thumbs up from the back, all good? Perfect, okay, great. Well, again, thanks so much for coming out today. I really appreciate it. My name is Andrew Reeves, and I wrote Overrun, Dispatches from the Asian Carp Crisis. I always like to start off with a little bit about who I am to have taken this on, because as Bruce sort of alluded to, it is a big sweeping book that I think a lot of people might look at a cover for something like this and assume it's like, yeah, it's a book about a fish, right? And it's like, well, yeah, but the joke around my home for a really long time was like, don't tell Andrew that he's written a book about fish, because you'll just launch him on a diatribe about how, it's like, no, let me explain to you. It's like, the fish is a mirror that we hold up to ourselves. It was like, and yeah, it can get pretty existential if you wanted to, but I'm going to keep it our feet firmly on the ground today. So I'm an environmental writer, as Bruce mentioned. I've been doing this since about 2012. This is easily my biggest endeavor. I got interested in Asian carp because in 2012, I wrote a feature for This Magazine about them. And it was about a 2,000-word feature. It was pretty small. I had to keep the focus like pretty tight on the Great Lakes. But there was so much that I wanted to explore that I just didn't have the time or the resources to do. Fast forward a few years, I was still a reporter working at Queen's Park, which is our legislature in Ontario. And I was getting a little tired of just the day-to-day grind of all of this. And a friend of mine I found out was applying for the Master of Fine Arts in Creative Nonfiction program at King's College in Halifax. And she had this amazing book that she wanted to write, and she said, you should apply. She's like, she was the editor-in-chief at the time at This, who I'd been working with on the feature that I wrote about Asian carp. And she said, you always talked about how there was so much more you wanted to do with this. And I said, yeah, you know what? You're right. And I applied, and they accepted me. And I ended up spending the next 4 years or so of my life, I was like writing the book that became Overrun. Now, the first question is, I'm not a biologist, I'm not a scientist. I was very much coming at this from the point of view of someone who had a training in finding the right people and going to the right places and asking the right questions, hopefully, but most importantly, just listening. So I always like to get that out of the way at the beginning, because I think when a lot of people hear a book about these fish, that they assume that I'm coming at it from that background. But in this case, no. I wanted to just make sure that I was grounding myself in the kinds of knowledge that I knew I was going to need in order to be able to write this. Because over the course of those 4 years, in some cases, I found myself writing about like how the glaciers formed the Great Lakes. And then the next day, I would be looking into how Reaganomics shaped the history of like economics in North America. And they all fit in this really remarkable way, which is always what I loved about the topic. It was always very broad. But if you want to distill it down, in a nutshell, what was I writing about? I was writing about these. Specifically, what we're looking at here are silver carp. And when we're talking about the Asian carp family, I'll be really clear right off the top. We're not talking about one fish, we're talking about a species of four. They are very closely related. So closely related, in fact, that two of them, silvers and bigheads, are able to reproduce with each other, and their hybrid offspring are capable of survival, and we've seen this happen throughout America. So, four very closely related species: grass, silver, bighead, and black. The book primarily focuses on grass, bighead, and silver, as they were the first three to arrive, and they're the ones that we often talk about most when we talk about the concerns we have about the fish arriving in North America, specifically in the Great Lakes. Because black carp were introduced a little bit later, they're at a different part of their invasion pathway, the research on them is much less substantial, so I don't write about them as much in the book. But when I spoke with people afterwards, they said that if I write a 10-year anniversary edition to Overrun, the new material that I will be adding in will be primarily focused on black carp. So they're coming. So why are we worried about them? Well, in a nutshell, we're worried about them because there's so many of them, and because they get really big. And you won't believe it necessarily from looking at the size of these fish. These are the small ones. That fish that you're looking at right there, that's very similar to the ones that I was on when I was on the Illinois River with some commercial fishermen. That fish is probably about 35 pounds, which is still very big by freshwater fish standards in North America, by and large. We don't have a lot of big fish that end up reaching those sizes that were native to North America. Some, increasingly less and less. So you have grass carp that are eating weeds, primarily. We brought them over here to be able to tackle problems we were having with aquatic weeds, which I'll get to in a minute. But why are we worried about them? What are the stakes, as it were, of grass carp making it in North America? What have they done in the United States where we've seen them? Well, they go after wetlands. And wetlands are valuable for a number of reasons. From a human-focused perspective, for starters, we'll be selfish for a minute, they perform billions and billions and billions of dollars worth of ecosystem services in terms of purifying drinking water, storing excess flood water, those sorts of things. They provide a very valuable service for us. Humans are also very, very good at destroying wetlands and paving over them and building condos, something we are exceptionally good at, which would be a lot easier, essentially, if they are already decimated by grass carp. The two that we saw back here, or the silvers that we saw here, they and big heads are filter feeders. So they just open up these very, very giant protruding mouths at the front of their bodies, and they basically just swim through the water column, and they just suck up whatever they can. Now, these fish can reach anywhere between 40, 60, 80, 100, sometimes 140 pounds. If you are a 140-pound fish that eats 20% of your body weight each day, you are taking in an extraordinary amount of food as you are moving through your habitat. And it just so happens that the food that they are eating is the exact same food that almost every single North American freshwater fish is eating in phyto and zooplankton, microscopic plants and microscopic insects that form the basis of the aquatic food chain for the vast majority of species. So this is why we are worried about them. Because not only do they grow so big, but they eat so much, but they breed much more rapidly, several times a year, so much more rapidly than most native freshwater fish in North America. And as I mentioned, we're also worried about the size. Because when you see fish like this, what this means is that in order for this one fish, with like a belly that is like very much protruding with tens of thousands of eggs, and it is able to spawn very easily. It takes, which I'll get to in the conclusion again, it takes fast water that we're seeing from flooding and extreme rainfall events. It uses that as a cue to be able to spawn. And it needs a certain length of river to be able to keep its eggs buoyant in order for them to survive. But all the studies we've done have shown that there are ample tributary rivers across North America that are long enough and just fast enough, but not too fast, that they would be able to support Asian carp growth. So that fish eats an incredible amount of food. And every bit of phytoplankton and zooplankton that it eats is one less bit of food that is available for freshwater fish. And so what have we seen in North America over the past number of years? We have seen that in certain stretches of the Mississippi River, and in the Illinois River in particular, that they have taken over ecosystems. So as around the late 1990s in Mississippi, 97% of the biomass, and by biomass I mean every living thing, in the Mississippi River was Asian carp, 97%. In parts of the Illinois River, there were more silver carp in particular than there were in their stretch of the Illinois River than there were anywhere else on Earth, including their native range in parts of northern China and southern Russia, where they are, irony of ironies, an endangered species now. And why are they an endangered species? Briefly, in their native range, overfishing. But they've been cultured in large parts of Asia for 8,000 years. So they've gotten very good at not only culturing them, but finding these appropriate techniques to be able to catch as many of them as possible. And so they're also eaten there in a way that they're not here. They also evolved with other species that are capable of keeping their populations in check. There was a researcher I spoke with at the University of Minnesota about this earlier in the year, and when I asked him, historically, what do you imagine in their native range might have been able to eat them to keep their population in check? He says that the records are a little bit hazy. The only thing that he could point to actually was river dolphins. So if you want to talk about the kinds of predators that you would need in order to be able to keep a fish that size in check, you're talking about something substantially larger, faster, smarter in a dolphin. And in many cases, in rivers across North America, we simply don't have anything that can really keep them in check. So, how did they get here? I spend the first third of the book or so really diving into that question. So I started in Arkansas, which was their ground zero, as it were, for their introduction to North America. And I remember I was in Keogh, Arkansas, meeting with a man named Mike Fries, who had spent years and years as a fish farmer and working with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. And I was sitting in his office, and as I detail in one of the chapters, I walk in, and his office has three main things I notice. Like, it's a huge amount of photos of him with his arms around other resource officials. It was like over the past decades. He has five stag heads on his walls, and he has shotguns and crossbows that are basically on every seat in his office. So, and he says, he invites me to take a seat across from him, and I end up having to like move a load, what might be it was loaded, I'm not sure. I had to move a crossbow out of the way in order to be able to sit down. So my bias shows, because this was not the kind of man who 5 minutes into our conversation I expected to hear name drop, this woman. It was Rachel Carson. I was not expecting that. It was like, and I detailed that very clearly in the book, and I own up, I believe, it was like to my own bias in this situation. I did not anticipate that Mike Fries in that context was going to tell me that he got into the fish rearing business, as did many others like him, because of Silent Spring and because of the advocacy of this one person. So I pressed him on it a little bit and then dove into the research a little bit more later on. But in a nutshell, the argument that Mike Fries gave me, which the research bore out as I dug more into it more deeply, was that for a very long time, this was unbelievably common, probably more so than anyone who was born from 1972 onwards can ever really fully appreciate. I hear stories from my mother-in-law who grew up in a rural town in Nova Scotia, who would tell me stories of trucks like, this is for farmland, obviously, but trucks from the government basically going down Main Street, it was like with these massive hoses, where they would just be blanketing neighborhoods in DDT in order to be able to control pests. So the book eventually starts diving into was like the history of DDT in a way and its impact in World War II and how it was brought home and basically touted as this miracle cure that was going to be beloved by housewives across the nation to be able to rid their pantries of pests. And it took off. But what Rachel Carson's book very, very clearly showed, there's one of the trucks up there, is that it was killing us. But it wasn't just killing us slowly. It was killing us slowly. But it was killing birds and reptiles and fish and small mammals in much more elaborate, much more quick moving ways. So often she uses the American sparrow, or sorry, the American robin, as an interesting case study there. Eggs that were basically made too brittle by the application of DDT that they weren't able to survive. Eagles that were not falling out of the sky, but were showing up in national parks and farmers' fields and suburban lands, who basically had seen that DDT bioaccumulate up the food chain, and as a top-level predator, they were feeling it the most. And so what happens is that right around the time that Silent Spring comes out, there's a meeting of resource officials in Arkansas. They invite someone from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization who comes in and he starts talking about a fish. It's cultured in China. Most of the men in that room had probably never heard of it before. It was called grass carp. It also went by the name White Amur, A-M-U-R, which is after the river that runs through their native range in China and Russia. And this representative from the UN, FAO, came in and he told all of these men in the room, these fish are miracle workers. You will not believe what they are capable of. It was like, they can eat aquatic weeds better than anything else can. And you know that book? That book that just came out, it was like by that rebel rouser? Well, this is perfect. She was suggesting that we needed biological, more natural alternatives, if you remember, to this. Because this we knew was killing us. But if we can find something that does this without us having to spray those chemicals, and then it's a win-win. Rachel Carson herself wrote about it in Silent Spring. I don't know that she necessarily had grass carp in mind, but that was the suggestion that came out of it. So these well-meaning resource officials are sold this idea of grass carp. They don't deliberate long. They are given a final warning by that man from the UNFAO who says, this is what I recommend, and it works really well in China, but before you do anything, think about it. Do some research, try and determine what the effects of these of this fish would be if it manages to make it into the wild here. Don't be hasty. The Americans waited a month. Within a month, we saw the first private shipments, or the first public shipments of this. So you had organizations like the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission. They were coming in. They were bringing them in. But so were universities. And interestingly enough, the U.S. government in one of their experimental agricultural stations in Arkansas got into a bit of an arms race with Auburn University in Alabama over the next decade, from 1963 to 1972, to basically be able to see who would be able to raise more of these fish in captivity faster. And they kept on outdoing themselves. Again, this odd arms race, until by around 1972, Auburn University was able to raise 100,000 viable fish fry in one go. What do you do with 100,000 fish fry? Well, they were still trying to figure it out. They were still doing routine tests to be able to determine whether these fish were actually going to live up to the hype. But 100,000 fish, what do you do with that? Well, they didn't want them to go to waste. So they basically threw open the doors, and they invited local fish farmers who were interested in finding ways to be able to make extra money if their rice crop hadn't done well that year, to come in and start raising fish in the hopes that they might be able to turn around and sell them later on to people who were interested in using them to clean golf course ponds, sewage lagoons, irrigation canals. It was touted as a business opportunity. But Auburn University was willing to cut people, do people the favor. And so they invited them in. They gave away, according to the records that I found in the archives at the University of Central Arkansas, Auburn University gave away about 98% of that 100,000 fish to, quote, persons unknown. We have no idea who they were, but they basically said, here are these sterile fish. Do with them what you want. But it turns out that they were right. These fish became known as ecology's fish, ecology's helper, in a number of ways. Articles like this, Superfish, no bird or plane, it's a white hammer, it was like with the Superman's crest on his chest. They were common. I love this image because I just think it basically, this is an amazing stand-in for the kinds of newspaper articles that were being written at the time about these fish. They truly were seen as miracles. The issue is we did not give much consideration, nor did we care really, whether they would be able to survive in the wild, let alone the implications that they would have. So we started using them for, again, in grass carp's case, we were using them to clean sewage lagoons and irrigation canals, but they were so successful for so long until we started noticing that grass carp started appearing in the wild. And then you start getting articles like this. And these are coming a little bit later on, so I think the example I have here is from 84. This one's from around the same time, but these kinds of articles started showing up in around the early or the mid-1970s. Usefulness of grass carp raised and stayed debated. Underwater mowing plan doesn't thrill all. And this came about when we started talking about, well, wait a minute. Maybe it's not such a good idea that we have these fish that are spreading everywhere across the country, especially considering that we started thinking about whether we were able to breed them to be sterile and then ship them across the country to be able to deal away with the fact that maybe they're in the rivers, but if we wanted sterile specimens, maybe that would work. So we had this larger debate, but not everyone was so thrilled with the idea, and this was when the pushback against grass carp really began. But before that happened, they decided to build on the success of grass carp by doing something pretty remarkable. They realized that there were two other closely related species, the ones I mentioned off the top, bighead and silver, that eat phyto and zooplankton. And they heard that these fish were amazing at cleaning up algae, better than any other fish possibly could. So this man, Homer Buck, I love his mustache, and he always looks like he just stepped out of a Graham Greene novel or a James Bond movie in all the photos I saw. This is in Illinois. And he and a man in Arkansas named Jim Malone were two of the primary drivers in bringing bringing bighead and silver carp to America. He is standing above a pen of pigs. And if you can see what the pigs are doing is that their pen is over top of some water. Homer Buck in Illinois is testing a really simple idea. Can we grow bighead and silver carp fed nothing but, as he put it, hog manure and sunshine? And down in Arkansas, Jim Malone and another man, seen here, a little fuzzier, this is in 1979 or so, a man named Scott Henderson, started testing an idea about whether they would be able to use carp to be able to solve sewage problems. And here was where my research took a really fascinating turn, but this is the kind of thing that as a writer, as a researcher, you love when it happens. So in 1972, to give you the brief rundown, the Clean Water Act was passed. Said a lot of things. The most important thing it said was that our age-old tradition of siphoning off solids and dumping untreated human waste in whatever river happened to be nearby was a really bad idea, for all the reasons that you might think that's a really terrible idea. So around that time, Silent Spring was still in the ether. We were still looking for biological solutions to those things. The Clean Water Act comes along and says, and tells small local governments across the country, you can't just keep dumping waste anymore. So suddenly they need to figure out, okay, well, what do we do? So the Environmental Protection Agency comes along and says, well, actually, there's this fish. And they're amazing. And they can clean sewage lagoons better than anything. They eat all of the algae that you want removed. So they started, for the Environmental Protection Agency for a time, started telling small governments who didn't have a, weren't able to build a massive sewage treatment plant, stock your lagoons with bighead and silver carp. They will be able to eat out all of that algae that you want. It's going to be a win-win situation for everybody. They were started touting this idea, but they needed to know whether it would work. So that's when they hired this man, Scott Henderson, to be able to run some pilots to see whether this idea would actually work. So Scott Henderson gets some money from the EPA and the Sport Fisheries Bureau. He strikes a deal with a hospital in Benton, Arkansas, and he starts raising these fish, same as Homer Buck was. It's like fed nothing really, basically, but like manure and sunshine. In Homer Buck's case, it was hog manure. In Scott Henderson's case, it was human sewage. At the same time that he was doing this study to be able to determine how effectively they could clean those lagoons, he also got $20,000 from the National Sport Fisheries Bureau to see those fish that we're raising in these sewage lagoons, could we eat them? And apparently this was something that the federal government in 1975 or so was willing to put money behind, and they did. They gave them 20 grand and said, sure, tack it on to your larger EPA study. Let us know what you find. So he wraps up all of his studies in the early 1980s, and what he finds is two things. Those fish were incredible at cleaning those sewage lagoons. And they were going to be able to save small county governments huge amounts of money that they did not have to spend on more expensive sewage treatment. He also found that despite the fact that they were eating nothing but human poop, that they were still low in BD5, other like you know other metrics that we use to be able to determine how healthy fish are for us to eat. They were incredibly healthy fish, despite their diet. And so Henderson actually did some back-of-a-napkin calculations and found that if those same county governments that bought these fish to clean their lagoons managed to find a buyer for the fish to sell them, to be eaten, that they could actually make a profit off them. So that's like a win-win-win if you're interested in eating fish that have eaten, raised on nothing but human poop. Shockingly, perhaps not, people weren't really all that interested in the ad idea. But what else happened around that time was Ronald Reagan was elected president. And one of the things that he did was effectively declare war on the environment. And so he slashed the EPA budget in half. He appointed Ann Gorsuch, who is the mother of their latest Supreme Court justice, Neil Gorsuch. Well, he wouldn't be the latest. And she, the two of them together basically cut the budgets, and they took the book of EPA regulations, and they boasted about shrinking it from 6 inches to about an inch. So you're doing away with most of the regulations that were in place. So this man here, Scott Henderson, he writes up his report, he sends it off to Washington, and he's expecting to hear a response back any day saying, this was so amazing, we should move forward with this. And he doesn't hear anything. Bless you. He calls his contact in Washington at the EPA after he hasn't heard back from them, and he says, what gives? I sent you this report. It had really great things to say. And they come back and say the budget for this has been part of the cuts that have been made. Please wind down all of your operations. So Scott Henderson is still alive, and I was able to track him down, and he and I had a wonderful conversation. And he mentioned to me that after he heard that distressing news, he went back, he told his team, they emptied out the lagoons that the fish were kept in, they hauled them all out, and he said that they were basically left to, they were put in a dumpster and left to suffocate to death. His speculation, and mine, that I, and a point that I share, is that not everyone was as dutiful as he was. So at this stage in the game, you have to remember, you had the federal government, you had state governments, you had private universities, all who had spent lots and lots of money investing in these fish, because they had been told by the UN, by the Environmental Protection Agency that there is an interest in keeping these fish around, you should cultivate them. Now all of a sudden, what do you do when the bottom drops out? Well, they didn't really have much to do with them. And suddenly, the fish started showing up in the wild. And so while Scott Henderson might have done his due diligence in destroying the fish when he wrapped up his experiment, my hypothesis, which he led me to, and the more research I did, the more we share that idea, was that not everyone was as diligent as he was, and as soon as people found out that there was never going to be a market for these fish, it was simply a lot easier to be able to open their sluice gates and to drain their own ponds that they were keeping the fish in and to let them go. Suddenly they weren't their responsibility anymore. And once they had access to one stream, we know how water systems work. Like small streams lead to bigger streams, which lead to rivers, which lead to gulfs, oceans, great lakes. And this is how when the fish were able to make it into some very, very small bayous, which I saw myself, like no bigger than this wide, but deep enough and wide enough that once the fish made it in, they followed it. And it led to increasingly bigger waterways, which has led them basically to the gates of the Great Lakes. I don't know whether I want to do a reading or whether I want to keep going with the presentation. I'll do like a very quick show of hands before I keep going. Are people interested in hearing what the book sort of sounds like, or do they want me to keep going in this vein? What do people prefer? Does anyone want a reading, or do they just want me to keep going like this? Reading? A couple hands? Keep going? Keep going. Sorry, keep going wins. You'll have to buy the book. So, where did they spread? This is a map produced by the U.S. Geological Survey. This specifically is grass carp, so I should be very, very clear about that. But what we're looking at right here, where you see the greatest concentration, does anyone know what waterway that is? That's the Mississippi. So you can see the places that they moved to first was this is Arkansas, this is Lone Oak, this was the ground zero where they started, which is why you see this very high concentration here. From there, like they made it into the Mississippi. They have now made it down here. Initially, our early projection was they can't survive in salt water. It's not really a problem. Even if they make it to the Gulf of Mexico, they won't be able to survive there. I'm not sure how many people are familiar with the geography of Louisiana, but the city of New Orleans sits below Lake Pontchartrain, which is very, very salty. It's not salt water. It's brackish, but it's very salty. So the fish came in on this side. For a very long time, we said, there's no way we're going to find them in the Pearl River over here because they would have to cross Lake Pontchartrain, which is unbelievably salty. It'll never happen. Well, it happened. There are now anecdotal reports of fishers who are actually working over here in parts of Texas and over here, as you can see, in parts of Florida and Alabama. They are now catching them off of piers in salt water. There were people I spoke with at Louisiana State University who suggested to me that it was really just a matter of time before they find ways to be able to like slowly make their way along the coast. We're not seeing that in numbers yet, but what we know suggests that there's really no reason why that isn't feasible. So where else have they spread? You see them over here on the west coast. Was it because they were brought there intentionally for use in sewage, again, in sewage lagoons, golf course ponds, irrigation canals? A lot of these movements outside of the Mississippi River system have been intentional introductions. But a lot of what you see along here, a lot of what you're seeing in parts of Iowa into Minnesota, Wisconsin. Do I have a clicker there? Yeah, I do. So you have like Wisconsin, parts of Iowa here, all of this, this is all natural. I was just in Kentucky recently, which is this state right here. What they're really worried about is that there's a huge boating community right around here, like a billion-dollar industry. And that part of the country right there is just starting to get bighead and silver carp now after having had grass carp for a number of years. And they are terrified. So what we're seeing is that after the fish has gone north-south, what are they doing now? Well, they're going east and they're going west. These are the new invasions of on the front lines. This is Sandusky, Ohio, so you'll notice a lot of them here. You're also seeing a lot of them, it was like in parts of Illinois. This is the Illinois River. And there are about seven breeding populations of silver and bighead carp now sit around right here, which is about 75 kilometers away from Lake Michigan. One of the things I want to discuss is, again, I'm from Toronto, so I'm right around here. The first thing that I wanted to do when I was mapping out what this book was going to look like was I needed to get outside of the Great Lakes. I'm aware of the Toronto Center of the Universe kind of thing, and I think that equally applies to the Great Lakes Basin kind of mentality. When you live in the Great Lakes, because of how unique they are in the world, it becomes really easy to think that the Great Lakes are the only important thing that matters from an ecological point of view, which is certainly the furthest thing from the truth. So what I wanted to do was, like, so again, my journey started down here in Arkansas, where I ended up meeting with a lot of people, like recreational fishermen, commercial fishermen, boaters, cottagers, who were able to detail to me, it was like all of the ways in which their livelihoods, but also just the lives they had built for themselves, their social lives, their recreation, all was basically being threatened by the fact that these fish were now here. So it became really clear to me the more I heard people say, but there's a $7 billion fishery in the Great Lakes that's at stake. And I'm like, I'm not going to turn my nose up at that. That's important. But you're never going to be able to convince me that that $7 billion fishery is more important to the people who live in the Great Lakes than crab fishing or shrimping is to people who live in Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi. What we know always matters a great deal to us. So it just so happens that in the Great Lakes, what we know are these massive inland seas that we care an awful lot about, which I'm glad. But I was really happy with part of the way that part of the research turned out, that I was able to talk to so many people who were able to convey to me how deeply those waterways meant to them. So, to take a few seconds though, if Asian carp are able to make it into the Great Lakes. I believe that this is from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. Year one after the introduction, assuming as we can from this heat area, red usually is bad and is true in this case as well. Chicago is right down here, which is where the Illinois, the Chicago River meets the Des Plaines River, which meets the Illinois River right there. I was chastised a lot when I was in Illinois because I tried to pronounce a lot of these French river names with my own terrible French accent and was constantly reminded of, no, it's not like Des Plaines, it's Des Plaines River. And so if you hear me say Des Plaines River and you think, oh my God, that guy from Ontario, terrible French accent, that is how they pronounce it there. So you have the Chicago River with its waterway connection here. So within 1 year, Lake Michigan is basically taken over, and you see them starting to make their way into Lake Huron. What does 20 years look like? If you're in Lake Michigan, it's a little better. If you're anywhere else, it's a lot worse. So you have Green Bay, Wisconsin here, which is now like one of the red hot zones. You have most of this part, like all of Lake Huron, all of Georgian Bay, sort of like the Great Lakes' little brother. All of that is going to be taken over. Interestingly, based on this projection, Sandusky, where most of the fish are coming from, still wouldn't have that many, largely because over the 20 years, they would have migrated. What is saving Lake Superior? Water hydrologic connections, the fact that the water is starting here before it makes its way this way and then out towards the Atlantic Ocean. Also just its sheer size and its coldness. What's saving Lake Ontario? Niagara Falls. Between just like the sheer drop, all of the water weight, the hydroelectric connections that we have there, there's not really a drop of water that flows between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario that is not being used for power production or isn't being hurled over the falls right now. So that is what saves it. If DFO was to do a projection for 40 years out, do I believe that Lake Ontario would still be as blue as it is? Anecdotally, no. Largely because we have actually found in the Toronto Islands right around here over the past number of years, we have been increasingly finding one-offs of grass carp. We have found as many of them as we possibly can, but ask any researcher and they'll tell you that doing electrofishing to be able to determine how many fish are underneath the water is incredibly difficult. And even though you think you might have them all, do you have them all? Probably not. But because I'm not in the Great Lakes Basin right now, because I am in Winnipeg, I wanted to give people a sense here that you're in trouble too. Not good news, but I'll get to the good news in a second. This was another DFO report that was done by several researchers who were unbelievably supportive in helping me write the book, none more than Becky Cudmore, who's the head of the Asian Carp Program for the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, based in Burlington, Ontario, right near Hamilton. They put this together a number of years ago because because Canada is on a different part of the invasion pathway, America spends a lot of their time doing research on what the impacts are. We spend a lot of our time trying to figure out, okay, if they get here, where can they survive? And what we have found is basically anywhere below the tree line, they are capable of survival. They will find adequate supplies of food. They will find adequate tributary rivers. The waters will not be too cold, nor will they be too hot. So any of the things that the Americans are experiencing right now in terms of huge growth in biodiversity, or in growth of Asian carp, losses in biodiversity, we would be seeing that throughout the entirety of the Great Lakes Basin, but right across the country, all the way. So, before I can take some questions, I want to say, what can we do about this? Well, the great news is there's actually a whole lot that we can do. And there's so many different variations on the answer as well. It depends on how much money you have. It depends on how organized you are. It depends on whether you're an individual or whether we're talking about like a country-wide sort of response. One of the interesting conclusions, if I do say so myself, I guess, from the book that I drew, is that there are a lot of really fascinating ways in which climate change overall is directly related to the spread of all invasive species, but I'm focusing on Asian carp. In a nutshell, you can read all about it in the conclusion, what we end up seeing is that there is a really direct correlation between, especially in the Midwest and in the Great Lakes, climate change has really manifested itself in that region or those regions in extreme weather events. In the city where I'm coming from, we're mostly worried about flooding. That is how we know climate change is going to affect our lives there. So another way that we can look at this as well is the way that we've built our cities. And Winnipeg, I'm sure, can relate to this. There's a lot of sprawl in Winnipeg. There's a lot of sprawl in Toronto as well. We have paved over a lot of area that traditionally used to be able to absorb a lot of rain. So, and then one more thing that I'll mention, agriculture. And I always make sure that I'm really clear when I talk about this. Farmers have been, and I've met a number of them, especially in Ohio, who have been doing tremendous work reducing the amount of fertilizer that is applied to their fields to be able to reduce some of that fertilizer being washed off and like farm runoff in the spring. The issue is increasingly less about the volume of fertilizer that is being applied to fields than issues with legacy fertilizer and just sheer volume. I don't need to tell anyone in Winnipeg was like about the amount of acres here, hectares that are being set aside for agriculture. And it's largely the same in places where Asian carp have proliferated, in parts of Ohio and in parts of Illinois. Illinois, basically between Chicago and Iowa, is just a cornfield. And so what ends up happening? Climate change is leading to more extreme rainfalls events. You're having more rain fall in shorter amounts of time. So when that rain falls, where is it landing? Well, if it's landing in our cities, is landing on that concrete, which isn't really able to absorb it, so it gets rushed into sewers. I'm not sure about Winnipeg, but I know that Toronto, Chicago, a surprisingly large number of cities have combined sewer overflows. Are there combined sewer overflows here in Winnipeg? I'm seeing some nods. So what ends up happening is that when you have huge amounts of rainfall that the sewers aren't able to control, what do? Well, they get dumped into these CSOs that are dumping roadway pollutants, rain. They're also dumping untreated human sewage. It was like in anything that happens to be in those sewers, and they get dumped directly into waters. It was like, which mixes, at least in the Great Lakes, with our drinking water. So it's also flowing into those rivers. Okay, so those rivers, and then you have rain that's falling on farmers' fields, which has too much fertilizer on it in a lot of cases, or there's a lot of issues with legacy fertilizer. A lot of that, if there are not proper care taken, it is dumping huge amounts of fertilizer into those waterways. Okay, let's take that one step further. So what's happening? You now have huge amounts of water that is making rivers whipping fast. Asian carp use fast water as a spawning cue because it helps keep their eggs buoyant long enough. If they lay their eggs in water that is moving too slowly, they can't stay afloat in the water column. They sink to the bottom, and if they get caught in the mud, they don't make it. So they want fast-moving water because it helps their babies survive. So we have these extreme rainfalls events that's creating perfect spawning conditions for them. Okay, so we can check that box. What is all of that fertilizer from farmers' fields and from cities that's mixing in with the water? What is that doing? Well, it's actually leading to huge growth in algae, these blooms that are happening. And that is a buffet for Asian carp. So these few ways that are all connected, these big, high-level conceptual challenges that we need to address, and I'm talking about big things, climate change, how we build our cities, how we grow our food, how we've designed our waterways, how we've manipulated them over years and years. These are big things. So if we want to have like a big collective way in which we can respond to the Asian carp crisis, that's what we would look at. But those are hard. I'm the first one to admit it. So if we're looking for smaller things we can do, well, Illinois is doing an amazing job right now. So this talk, the conclusions differ depending on where I am. Illinois is doing an amazing job right now paying commercial fishers to do what they do best, to go out onto the water and to be able to haul as many of those fish out of the water as they possibly can. And it looks like this. This is called the Unified Fishing Method. This is one of those funny things in happenstance. One of America's leading Asian carp thinkers, a man named Dwayne Chapman, who works in Missouri for the U.S. Geological Survey, he was reading through some translated Chinese fisheries documents from the 60s, and he came across something that was referred to as the Unified Chinese Method. And he's like, I have no idea what that is. But he has a lot of colleagues who work for like universities and institutions in China. So he called a few up and said, I've been seeing this in the literature. What is this? So it's an incredibly elaborate system that takes 3 weeks, a lot of boats, and a lot of nets. And rather than have one boat go out, like there was a photo at the beginning, where you have fishermen go out and they'll lay like one string of nets in one small area, and they might haul in 7,000 pounds in a day. It's a lot of fish. It's not nothing. But what they found was that with these unified method, you will find the perfect waterway where you are able to basically channel fish into increasingly smaller areas. So you lay your nets in these elaborate concentric sort of half circles, and then you get all of the boats around the periphery and they all just gun their engines and the fish get terrified from the sound, and you basically corral them into these smaller and smaller areas, closing it off with nets behind you. And over the course of 3 weeks, you can haul in as many fish as you would normally be hauling out in about 3 months. So it's incredibly effective. They've been doing this combined with some of their other more traditional fishing techniques since 2011, and they have hauled out around 8 million pounds of fish directly south of Chicago. Now, these are the fish that would be pressing up against the electric barriers that are currently in place to keep Asian carp from making it into Lake Michigan. So that's huge. So when you now go fishing for silver and bighead carp south of Chicago, you're no longer finding huge numbers of them. You're just finding the giant fish because they're kind of on their own. All of their friends have been caught, as it were, so they're kind of left swimming around. They have the lion's share of the food to eat, but no one to reproduce with. So it's good news, and it's cheap. Those commercial fishermen that we pay, they get paid about $2,500 per crew per week. And I should put that into context. We balk at the idea of paying commercial fishermen $2,500 per week, but yet the Army Corps of Engineers a few years ago was floating a project to hydrologically separate the Great Lakes from the Mississippi River system at a cost of $18 billion. They're now moving ahead with a slightly smaller version of that plan, and over the 2 years that they've been debating it, the cost went from $276 million U.S. up to about $900 million U.S. So we will think about spending that amount of money. We will authorize that. But yet, for some strange reason, when it comes to creating local jobs and paying these fishermen, we're like, well, how useful can this be? Tremendously so. So these are options. I'll wrap up now and say so many other things that we can do. We can employ scientific methods to be able to stop them. We can create markets to eat them. We can either eat them ourselves, or I visited a plant near the Iowa-Illinois border that was liquefying them and turning them into fertilizer for plants. They had aspirations of liquefying an invasive fish to turn it into fertilizer for the medical marijuana community that was growing up around the time. And how incredible a time that is that we would be finding ways of using an invasive fish in such a way, I think. So there's so much that we can do. I really just want to sort of like leave us. Oh, this is another photo from the Unified Method. So you can just see these groups of local fishers from different state agencies. This is the last haul that comes out. Basically, what they will then do is take the perimeter of the net and they'll either haul it into the shore or they get a giant crane offsite to basically lift down and grab the net and haul the fish out. And it's incredibly effective. But what the question I want to sort of leave you with is this doesn't have to be the future for the Great Lakes. But there are a lot of questions that we need to ask ourselves. Do we want to just call the Great Lakes and all of these waterways in Canada, do we want to call them precious, which is a word that I hear thrown around a lot, or are we willing to actually to pay for this? Are we willing to acknowledge that there are these deep connections between climate change and the spread of an invasive fish? Are we willing to be less picky in how we eat fish here? Because they are a very bony fish, but they'll taste like whatever you want them to. So are we willing to eat them? Are we willing to feed them to our pets? Are we willing to say we want to protect these waterways and we know that it'll cost, but we are willing to do it? Because one of the favorite things I heard from a research subject is that we needed to stop thinking about Asian carp as an illness. They are just a symptom, and we have the cure anytime we want to use it. So thank you so much. Yeah, it is very effective, and bycatch has been a problem in other ways. The way that Illinois has gotten around bycatch with their traditional fishing, bycatch is the term for, I want to pull in Asian carp, but I might also happen to pull up catfish. I was like, well, I want that catfish back in the water, so how do I get it back in? So Illinois has gotten around this problem by every time they send a commercial fisher out for their traditional fishing methods, when they haul in the net at the end of the day, there is a biologist who works for the state government on board the boat who effectively keeps the commercial fishers honest. And so as they haul in the nets and they're hauling out Asian carp, if they come across native fish that don't belong in there, they immediately throw them back in. And from what I understand with the unified method, it's a little bit harder because of the sheer volume. But as they bring those concentric circles in, you have, as we saw in that last photo, dozens of people who are standing around who are also managing for that kind of quality control, as it were. But I would wager, from what I understand, that if you're talking about catching in 3 weeks what you would normally need 3 months, you might have more of a concern with bycatch.
Is that right?
When they're pulled out and then thrown back in, it's in the same way that we have like catch and release fishing, which there's some question as to whether that is traumatizing for the fish as well. They remain in the water. I saw myself when I was on the boat. They remain in the water for a very long time, until basically they're hauled out, and then it's pretty clear when you're seeing just like silver, 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 big head, silver, catfish, throw it back in. It's pretty easy to be able to notice the other ones. They did notice, interestingly enough, how smart Asian carp were in a lot of ways. So when they paid those commercial fishers to go out onto the Illinois River, they found in the first couple of years that they weren't getting, if they hit the same stretch of river, like every other week, they thought, yeah, there'll still be a bunch of fish here that we've missed and we'll be able to catch them. But what they found was that the fish actually had recollections of the trauma of either like avoiding the nets or the boat motors, and found it so terrifying that they actually had to give the fish about 5-6 weeks in between visits to the same stretch of river in order to basically allow them to forget or become calm enough before they went back to hit that part of the river again. Because if they came back too soon, they wouldn't catch any of them, because the fish would learn that, like, oh yeah, the nets don't go all the way to the bottom of the river. So even though I might be spooked, some of them jump, but some of them actually just like submarined and were able to avoid the nets entirely. I believe so. They're able to survive long enough outside the water that when they, and they're also not out of the water long enough that when they put them back in, the fish are able to survive. Yeah. No, in this case, from what I understand, that's why they have the biologist on board to be able to make sure that they're back in a reasonable time. Any other questions? Yeah. The short answer would be no. And it's interesting because there's a lot of people, when I give variations on a talk like this, like some people will ask, let's say, like, well, yeah, like, what, again, was anyone held responsible for this? And the reality is, when grass carp first came over, and I spent a lot of time talking about this in the early parts of the book, I wanted to really make it clear that I wasn't about vilifying anyone, simply because they were reading the peer-reviewed literature. This was in the same way that we might find it kind of incredible now to think that like people thought that smoking was healthy for as long as it was, let alone benign. There was research at the time, as bogus as it might have been historically, that suggested this is a good idea. And so there was a lot of peer-reviewed global research at the time that said these fish are not only amazing at what they do, but you don't need to worry about them because it was like, we kept on saying, well, in their native range, it was like, they're only a small part of it. But like ecology as a discipline was so new at the time that no one really bothered saying, well, yeah, but that's because they have evolved in that habitat. They haven't evolved with the same relationship with other species here. So at the end of the day, no, simply because it was really hard to pin down. What was a little easier to pin down was that the first private shipment of bighead and silver was made by one man, Jim Malone, who I had mentioned earlier. His son still runs their fish farming business in Keough, Arkansas. I called him up to see about doing an interview with him about his dad, and I had to leave a voicemail, and as I was doing another interview, he called me and left me a message, and I remember when I checked my messages, he said, yeah, you're welcome to stop by the farm tomorrow to talk, but he's like, I just want to make it really clear. It's like, my family is not to blame for this, and if you suggest we are, like, I'll throw you off my property real quick. And we got along really well once I was there. I think he ascertained pretty quickly that, like, I was just there to learn. I wanted to know more about his dad because his dad had played such a big role in bringing them here. And it was only later on in his life that I think he finally realized that it was maybe not a great idea. But yeah, it took a really long time for people to sort of come to terms with it. But in terms of like a reckoning, no.
I was thinking when it comes, one more question. I was going to say when it comes to, not villains, but Rachel Carson, because it's Rachel Carson, of course, because it's Silver Spring in her book, is why we stopped using DDT and we had to look for other things. So, mm-hmm. I mean, in a sense, you could blame Rachel Carson for part of this crisis, too.
Well, and at the end of the chapter where I talk about this, I did feel it was important to mention that there are still some people who believe that like the decision to stop using DDT was not necessarily the right call to make, because, yes, we traded the health of some of those eagles and some of those other animals that I showed you at the beginning for the health of people in many parts of the world where DDT was still incredibly necessary to be able to keep populations of mosquitoes spreading malaria in check. So the question really was, yes, we have more bald eagles, that's great, but the U.S.'s freeze on DDT might have been indirectly or directly responsible for other repercussions in other parts of the world. So these things are never as simple as they might seem. Yeah. Yeah, it was parts of the Mississippi, yep. Okay, so the answer to the first part of the question, what we usually see, if we go back a second, if I'm able to this one. So you remember here, look at Lake Michigan right here, and you can see that it's like fire engine red for most of it. But then by 20 years, it kind of mellows out a little bit. And that, I think, is maybe like a good visual representation of what has happened in the Mississippi and in parts of the Illinois. So really early on, the 90s was when they first started making it to those upper reaches of the Mississippi and the Illinois River. That's when you would have seen the Mississippi and the Illinois looking like this. Do they look like that now? No. The percentage of the biomass has leveled off. It's hard to pin an exact figure on this for many reasons. Anecdotally, I have heard from some of the researchers I've spoken with that they'd peg it maybe now between 55 and 65. So like still a majority of the living things in the Mississippi River and in the Illinois, but not devastating like this. So that has led to other species who have been able to rebound to a certain degree, which has been good news. It's just one of those things where if you're hoping that like, well, wait a minute, how do I get the Mississippi to look like this again? It's like, I want it to be that color again. Well, the good news, and this is often what I'm asked, like, what does victory look like? Well, victory kind of looks like this, I think. Victory, because this, at one, this is Asian carp as part of an ecosystem. You see those red areas, that is Asian carp as the dominant feature in that ecosystem, which is a very different thing. So now we're seeing that they are part of it, a destructive part, a part that we don't want there, a part that we spend millions trying to reduce, but they are not taking it over. I'm not sure whether people are familiar with what happened with sea lamprey in the Great Lakes in the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and into the 90s. Sea lamprey came in, they were an accidental introduction. they're kind of like vampire-like fish that are like that will like they look like eels almost that will glom onto the side of another fish and literally just like suck the life from them, and then when their host dies, they swim away and find another. We found a way to be able to control them. There's a chemical cocktail that we can apply to rivers where sea lamprey spawn, and it has reduced their populations by about 90%. So now they are a part of that ecosystem as opposed to a thing that is destroying the ecosystem. But what does that cost us? About $20 million every year that we split with the United States. And that's $20 million every year in perpetuity throughout time and space. We can never stop doing that, because if we stop doing that, then their populations will just take off again. And the second part of your question was, what does Asian carp look like in the Great Lakes right now? So we have seen over the past 15 years or so, the Grand River, which flows through parts of southern Ontario right here, we have found live specimens of big head and grass carp in parts of the Grand River. And the most recent one was in the September of 2015 on the Toronto Islands. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with Toronto, but there's an island, and there's an island airport down at the bottom of where the water at the shore. Perfect habitat for Asian carp. And in 2015, in the end of the summer, we found about 8 of them that were swimming around there. And it was all hands on deck. We called the Ontario Ministry of Ministry of the Environment and Natural Resources. We had the Department of Fisheries and Oceans come in. Everyone brought their boats, their electrofishing gear. They spent days and days searching the river trying to find any more of them, and they did not find any more of them there. Do they believe that they caught all of them? No. Did they find any more? No. So they've been one-offs, basically. You'll find 4 or 5 fish that will show up here in the Sandusky River in Ohio. You'll find one in the Grand River here. You'll find these ones on the Toronto Islands. Or you'll find like little pockets of them in like Green Bay, like 1 or 2 of them. Never a breeding population. There's some speculation about how many fish you would need to create a breeding population. A couple years ago, DFO did a study on this. They commissioned a researcher at the University of Waterloo, right around here in Ontario. She found through her modeling that it would only require 20 fish. 10 males, 10 females, to find each other in a tributary river, and that would be all it would take. So the threshold for an invasion starting is pretty low, but have we seen one? Not yet. So there is still time. The crown jewel that was sort of presented to me in all of this is that the great thing that has come out of this crisis has been the amount of cross-border collaboration that Canadian agencies have done with their American colleagues. So we are not just a passive participant. We have a seat at that table. We are bringing valuable research to the table, and they are sharing best practices with us, up to and including ways that DFO is using when they go out to be able to monitor for Asian carp. We've been learning from them their best practices for how to be able to try and rustle them up when we go out onto the water. And I will end with this very amazing anecdote that I thought was great. I was out on the Credit River in just west of Toronto with some government agents, and we were out looking for silver carp and big head carp in the river. And we had laid out our nets, and they were just about to gun the motor to be able to scare all of the fish. And I was handed this contraption, and it was a broom handle that had a plunger bottom screwed onto the bottom. And with this contraption, they did 2 things. They used the hard end to smash on the bottom of the aluminum boat to be able to make this huge boom underneath the water. And then when they wanted a different kind of sound, they flipped it over and they took the toilet plunger version, and they would lean over the side of the boat and just slosh at the water, with the idea being that if you wanted to terrify the fish into swimming into your nets, sometimes after a while they get used to the sound of the boat motor. But if they're hearing all of these terrifying complex sounds together, it'll spook them. So then when I asked, it was like, where did you get this idea to use this like broom handle and a plunger? And he said, we heard about this down in the United States. That's what they're using on the Illinois River. So these are the kinds of best practices. It's not always scientific. Sometimes it's $10 worth of parts at a hardware store.